Emails are a continuing revelation and a series of revelations that have come out slowly in the past year and a half that indicate what appears to be a concerted effort to construct a narrative.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Cheryl Atkinson. She's the award-winning journalist who recently parted ways with CBS after the press said it was due to friction between her and her bosses at CBS and her investigations into things like Benghazi, Fast and the Furious, and other cases. Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You, at your website at CherylAtkinson.com, you say your credo is that you're resisting undue corporate, political, and other special interests, and you're the author of the forthcoming book. It'll be coming out in the fall, Stonewalled, My Fight for the Truth Against the Forces of Obstruction, Intimidation, and Harassment in Obama's Washington. Talk a little bit about Benghazi, because this was the story that you're probably best known for at this point in time, and it certainly caused a lot of controversy. We've just learned that, in fact, the White House did have emails where they were pushing Susan Rice and other people who were talking about Benghazi very early on to stress that this was, in the quote of Ben Rhodes, the guy behind this email, that Susan Rice and others should underscore that these protests at the Benghazi compound are rooted in the Innocence of Muslims video and not a broader failure of policy. Is this a vindication of the coverage that you were working on?
Well, I would start by saying, to the extent that anyone has believed that covering Benghazi is a legitimate news story is a controversial thing to do, it's kind of what I'm writing the book about. There's an effort to controversialize reporting that can be damaging to certain interests, and it's their effort to make it appear as though very legitimate lines of criticism and fair reporting are in fact somehow controversial. And by saying it often enough, I think they've convinced people that in fact it is.
So, I mean, what you're saying is that even to get to a point where, you know, when you say, okay, well, let's find out what actually happened at Benghazi, what were the steps leading up to it and leading away from it, you've been told again and again, or people, you know, in the Obama administration and some people who are sympathetic to them in the press are saying, look, there's nothing to discuss here. The only reason you're interested in covering this is because you have an agenda or a vendetta against Obama.
And I think that's a well-orchestrated strategy that is somewhat successful, but it's pretty easy to see through if you analyze it. I would say the groups that have tried to controversialize my reporting, let's look at some of this, the main stories, Fast and Furious, as you said, Benghazi, and my green energy debacle stories. Mm-hmm. All three of them, by a neutral peer group, were nominated or received Emmy Awards on a national basis. Those are not partisan journalists who award those things. So you can either listen to sort of neutral news reporting, which is what I do, or you can listen to those who are accused of mismanagement and wrongdoing who say, of course, that the reporting's inaccurate.
Let's talk first about Benghazi and the emails. Does it surprise you that these are emails which Congress, actually, the Oversight Committee in Congress, asked for these emails. They subpoenaed them. They were not able to get them. They came to light through a lawsuit being brought by Judicial Watch, which is a far right or, you know, antagonistic to Democratic nonprofit group. So it came out. Do these emails show that the White House has been acting dodgy about just the events leading up to and away from Benghazi?
Well, the White House has not been forthcoming with the information we've asked about this issue. And I, too, have requested those documents under Freedom of Information over a year ago and have not received them, even though under the law they are required to provide them to me as they provided them to Judicial Watch. They haven't yet. But, yes, the emails are a continuing revelation and a series of revelations that have come out slowly in the past year and a half that indicate what appears to be a concerted effort to construct a narrative. I think it was pretty obvious early on that this was happening based on documents and witness testimony. So I think this just adds a little more meat to it.
What is the narrative? I mean, is the narrative, clearly it's a scandal, you know, or it's not even a scandal. It's a tragedy that, you know, a number of U.S. personnel, including the ambassador to a newly liberated Libya, were killed. Clearly, a failure of policy implementation, of security procedures, of nation building, or whatever. I mean, you know, it's just failure all the way around. Why are they trying, you know, what are they trying to do to keep people from asking and, you know, getting answers to legitimate questions of, like, why did this happen?
I think, like any government that may be facing criticism, especially 8 weeks before a presidential election.
Right.
This was crucial and could have been devastating to them. If we knew everything now, then that we know now, like 1 week after it happened, I think that really would have been devastating to the campaign. But I think the primary goal for any political group that is in a position like this would be to delay the release as long as possible of the damaging details, which they've effectively done in many cases. And as they dribble out slowly, they begin to say, well, now it's old news and who cares? And they've had time to try to politicize and controversialize the reporting, which all serves the purpose, I guess the initial goal.
And I guess, you know, to move into Fast and Furious, this is another story that you effectively broke, which was seen as potentially very damaging to the Obama administration, who tried to say, oh, no, this didn't happen, or we had no knowledge of it, or that it was a holdover from the Bush administration. Can you recap for us just briefly what Fast and Furious was about?
Fast and Furious was an effort. When I first began covering the story, we thought perhaps even a small local effort, misguided on the part of federal officials from the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Federal Agency, to catch criminals and Mexican cartel lords in Mexico by doing the unthinkable, which is letting guns through traffickers fall into the hands of the cartels and see where they end up, with the idea that then we can catch a major cartel, you know, kingpin,
right,
and this will be better because we can prove that guns come from the United States and arm the cartels. In fact, it turned out to be something much bigger than Phoenix. There were many operations with different names that were happening simultaneously in other states. This is a wonderful lesson in why not to initially believe the government's proclamations about mm-hmm. things without checking yourself, because initially the government story evolved from, you know, this never happened, the whistleblowers are lying, which
right.
was, you know, proven false. Then they said, well, it was isolated to Phoenix, Arizona, which was false. Then they admitted, okay, ATF headquarters in D.C. knew about it, but nobody at Justice knew of the case, which turned out to be false. Then Justice Department said, well, we had some knowledge, but nobody at the White House knew of the case, which turned out to be false. And then the president declared executive privilege so that we can't see those final documents.
Why is it that, you know, people, you know, this stoked the imagination of the right and of Obama critics? Why do you think it did not catch on bigger in the American population? Is it that the story doesn't matter, or it's too confusing, or that the administration's kind of slow drip strategy actually worked?
I do know at the time when I was starting to cover it that other reporters were also trying to cover the story, and that they were being prevented from their editorial bosses. The stories were being prevented from airing. So sometimes the ground level reporters do want to cover these stories, but you have to get past other hurdles. And there are managers, if they don't see it as a story or they want to block the story, it won't get published. So I think because it wasn't widely published, first of all, it didn't catch on. I was, you know, I and I guess Fox News and a few other outlets were covering it. And then it was successfully fairly politicized, even though it was revealed that the government had, in fact, not been telling the truth about it.
Right.
By the time all of that came out, it was had been portrayed as a Republican versus Democrat controversy. So
right.
half the people didn't care, and the other half thought maybe it was political.
Yeah, you know, and we're hearing rain now because of our poorly insulated studios. So if people hear a drumbeat, that's what it is. You know, what happened to journalists? You know, I checked on Wikipedia, and I won't reveal your age, and I also won't reveal that you're actually the creator of Bitcoin. But you're around my age. I know that when I got into journalism, part of the whole thing was that you wanted to speak truth to power. You know, it was very much watching at least the movie version of All the President's Men. You were saying that reporters in, or not even reporters, but editors and the people who call shots in major media outlets, what happened to them that they no longer, when they see a government lying to its people in a pattern, systematic way, and they're saying, no, that really, don't cover that. That wouldn't be of interest. That wouldn't be good. You know, what's going on in American newsrooms?
I think it's a complex set of factors. And if you try to give one explanation, you can find an exception to it that mm-hmm. disproves it. So it's a little bit of a generalization that I'll make. But I'll say, yes, there are some ideological forces at play. But yes, there are also competing pressures not to offend certain corporate interests.
Mm-hmm.
And also our corporate managers are tied into both corporations and politicians. It's all, to me, it's become almost all one and the same. The interests of the government, the interests of corporations, and the interests of the news media have kind of melded together, whereby I think in many instances, the news media is not doing that good old government watchdog job that
now,
they used to do.
Can I ask, is this, I mean, you worked at CBS News. CBS has been a major corporation that had, you know, I mean, they used to own the New York Yankees, for God's sake. This is a very diversified company, which itself can be owned by other people, et cetera. Has it really changed, or like what is going on? Because why should we look back 20 or 30 years and say, or 40 years and say CBS would have been more independent then, because it was still a giant corporation that was going to be going to the government to say, hey, you know, we need this FCC license or this ruling, or could you help us out on this? What's changing that, if your thesis is correct, that the corporations and the news media corporate interests and political interests are tighter now? What's happened?
I can't explain why in the past 2 to 3 years especially that I've noticed it more, but it's impacted, I believe, my work more so. There have always been challenges along the way. There are challenges in every newsroom. There are competing interests and competing pressures, but those have traditionally been fairly navigable overall. Something different is happening, and I can tell you, I just returned from an investigative reporting conference in Berkeley, California, where top Pulitzer Prize winning journalists were all making the same observations as we are, from the New York Times and formerly LA Times and Washington Post, and very prestigious and well-respected outlets have all said there's something happening now. I think the New York Times, James Risen or Lowell Bergman, who's another independent journalist, said they called it a fundamental change in society, and they said maybe it started prior to the Obama administration, but it's continued during the Obama administration and gotten worse, and that journalists, they say, basically need to, as you said, you know, speak to the power and do something about it, because this is, in their view, unprecedented.
Are they, I mean, but how about the, I mean, you say over the past couple of years it's gotten particularly worse. How much of this could we just say is that, you know, it's for a long time it's been that particularly mainstream, large circulation newspapers in D.C. and New York, or media outlets, you know, they tend to be Democratic, they tend to be liberal Democrats. They loved Obama. I mean, it was unabashed for a lot of reasons. Is it just that they are covering their guy, you know, they're throwing themselves on him to save him in a way that they wouldn't do that with George W. Bush?
A piece of the puzzle, yeah. I think, is the idea that many people hoped this president would be different in terms of transparency and openness with the press. I think they gave him the benefit of the doubt and then some, hoping that it would change, and felt some people, I think, are so ideologically entrenched that it outweighs their journalism instincts, and they hope against hope that this is something good for the country, and they don't want to be part of what they see as an effort or a vehicle that fights that. I think there's some
component of that. But you're also saying it's not the whole of the story, and that when Obama is gone, we're still going to be faced with this kind of interlocking directorate of corporate power and political power.
As one whistleblower put it to me, a government whistleblower, things have never been worse for the people that try to speak the truth inside the government about illegalities and wrongdoing. And in their view, and I tend to agree, every administration is perhaps a little bit more clamped down and closed than the one before it, and the next one starts from that finishing point. It's very hard to make it go backwards. There are rules being instituted now against journalists and the type of work that we do that I think will be very hard to unwind.
Can you give an example of that?
There was, a rule passed this week, and I didn't research it. It was announced at the Investigative Reporting Conference, so if I'm not relaying it exactly correctly, forgive me, but it's about apparently James Clapper has instituted a new rule that makes it illegal for anyone in the intelligence agencies to speak to reporters about anything. Mm-hmm. That's how it was described to us, which is hugely restrictive and way more so than anything that had been done in the past, which means the very guy who did not tell the truth to Congress a few months back when asked, or maybe it was last year, about these surveillance programs, has since been put in charge of fixing the problem, the government's overreach, and he's doing so by overreaching even further into, you know, people's rights to speak about what's going on.
Now, you know, you paint a dark picture. Isn't it also true, though, that, you know, with the rise of groups like Anonymous, WikiLeaks, the Edward Snowden revelations, independent journalism, whether it's things like Vox or things like, you know, the new project that Glenn Greenwald and others have done it with money from the eBay fortune. Is it Is it also simultaneous as the government is clamping down more, they're doing that partly because more and more stuff is getting out? And do you see, is it a bright light or a dim light of kind of truly independent journalism that goes outside of, you know, major outlets like the New York Times or the Washington Post or CBS News?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. The problem with relying on independent outlets and blogs and alternative news sites is they have very little clout. And the government has systematically been, in my opinion, instituting rules and policies that close down legitimate press inquiry and basically replacing that with their own propaganda machines. And, you know, at some point that becomes fairly insurmountable, no matter how independent you are and how much you try to dig. If they've been able to control access to such a degree that the mainstream press, I couldn't get into certain government buildings to cover stories because I think unfairly and perhaps unlawfully they banned me, or for reasons that could be challenged in court, they banned me. But if we don't challenge those rules and policies and they become codified, what chance does an independent blogger stand of getting access to the things that he needs?
Let's talk a little bit about your politics, because once you became more critical of the Obama administration, or, you know, which also on a certain level makes sense, that, you know, if you're covering the White House or you're covering big stories of the day, it's always going to be the person occupying the White House. But you were talked about as you were a hyper conservative, you were a secret Republican, etc. I mean, the fact of the matter is you've also reported stories that are pretty damaging to the Republican Party. And one that maybe we can talk a little bit about is the way that a series of freshman GOP members who were Tea Party favorites, who had pledged not to hang out with special interests and whatnot, went on a kind of all expenses paid junket to talk to lobbyists. Can you talk a little bit about that story?
Well, we got a tip and we found a way to get access to this group of freshman Republicans who went to a fundraising event down in Key Largo, Florida, that seemed to be giving, you know, extremely special access to lobbyists and other interests. Sometimes it was theorized on committees on which they sit. I don't know if a lot of people know now. The congressional committees, in my view, based on my experience, instead of overseeing some of the industries that they're supposed to oversee, use those positions to get donations from those industries, right, to basically not oversee them. So it's kind of this upside down world. So we did confirm they wouldn't let us know the names of the people who attended this event, but we know there was at least one banking lobbyist, and some of these members sit on the banking committee. So it was just an example of the appearance of politicians saying one thing and doing quite another when doors
and
are closed.
There was nothing illegal, you know, as far as that you could ascertain going on. I mean, this was a legitimate fundraising thing, but it's a case in point of political hypocrisy.
It's the kind of secret access that people with money and power get that ordinary people can't get from members of Congress. That's the example.
When is your book going to be coming out?
It should be coming out in November if the schedule stays put.
Okay. Thank you, Cheryl Atkinson, for talking to Reason TV about power, you know, political power, corporate power, economic power, and media power, and whether or not that's shrinking or not.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.